KPFK 90.7 FM. Melting Pot is the name of the show. What you were just listening to was a group called the Darling Dears and Funky Heavy Production providing the background sound. And that was a 45 that was originally released on the Flower City record label. And if you find that in its original, it's really gonna set you back a pretty penny. Last copy I saw was somewhere around $1,500. But that 45 has been reissued by the label Cultures of Soul, and right now in our studios we actually have Dino Sounds. He's the owner of Cultures of Soul. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me over.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. We're actually gonna chat for a little bit, and you brought in a whole bunch of vinyl, so you're gonna do a guest DJ set for us, which I'm really excited to hear. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was just kind of a little bit of biography, especially about the label and how this all got started. When did you really get interested in these kind of rare sounds?
Well, I've been collecting records now for 10 years and just collecting more stuff, you know, getting enough stuff so I can sell some stuff on eBay and other sites, and kind of learning what records are really rare to find and interesting for other people. And, you know, I started a little radio show on Viva Radio, and I wanted to focus on kind of rare sounds from rare sounds that you can dance to from across the globe. And that's kind of the concept behind Cultures of Soul. And then I think it was 2009 or so, I started the label. We put out our first record by the original Black Sheep of the Family. I had a friend of mine who also did a radio show who actually connected with the guy who did that record. And that's kind of how I got into it from there. So,
what is that? Just for, you know, there's quite a few, I don't know, I guess you could call them like reissue labels or kind of revivalist labels. I don't know exactly if there's a term for the kind of label that you run, but there are a few labels out there now. It's a big help to people who enjoy these sounds, because, you know, even 10, 15 years ago, a lot of these sounds were extraordinarily rare. You would never hear them. And now it's really provided this avenue for people to hear these sounds and to enjoy these sounds and to still be able to pay their rent. You know, but I'm really interested in just like how did you just get it started? Like you talk about it as if it was like no big deal. Yeah, we just started a label. But it seems like this would take, you know, like this would seem like quite an endeavor to start up a reissue label like this.
It is, and it could be a big headache a lot of times. So it's just what, you know, I guess it makes it sound easy because it's just, you know, my passion. It's what I, you know, what I want to do. And you know, really just kind of studying other people that paved the way. Numero, Now Again, those, you know, really studying what they do. I did have some experience in the record business for a while. Worked for Sony for a little bit. And also doing some other music administration. So I kind of learned the back end from that, read about it a lot. And just being a record fanatic and DJing out and, you know, looking at where the dance floor reacts to certain songs and, hey, this isn't been put out again, and this is really a great track that should see the light of day. And that's pretty much it. Just, you know, hunting and digging for people. And, you know, you might, you know, someone might know someone who played the keyboards on this track, and then you contact that guy, and then he knows who the guitar player, and the guitar player did see the guy who owns the copyright and was the singer who wrote it, you know, 2 years ago, so he's got this number. So it's really like being a, you know, a detective and really hunting the people down. And you know, it's exciting once you finally get at the end of the trail.
I bet. And at this point, the label is about 4 years old?
Yeah, 4 years.
Okay.
Much, yeah.
And it's moved from, you know, just a few 45s. There's actually quite a bit of material the label's been able to release over these 4 years. I'm wondering, in talking about kind of how you track down not just the music, but track down these artists, I'm wondering if you would share one of kind of like the strangest or like most amazing stories in connected to tracking down these artists of these sounds.
They're all pretty strange. None of them are clear cut. You know, sometimes easier than us. Sometimes collectors bring people to me and are like, hey, you know, there's a guy, Andy Noble, and there's a project we might be working on soon. They just contact me today. It's like, hey, I got this. Get back to me soon. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's easy. He helped me with the Cosmos Universal Band putting that 45 out, which was a pretty in-demand record. Probably one of my favorite stories, just because the guy is such a great guy and everything, was the Emmons Pyramid Project and tracking down Andre Evans. Because that was a story. It was kind of like the story I just mentioned, where a friend of mine, PJ Gray, who did a show called Galactic Fractures, he, for some reason, hunted down the guy who played keyboards live with him sometimes and added it to some of the studio stuff. So I finally got in contact with him. Then, you know, just bugging these guys for months. And then finally he remembered he had a number for the guitar player that also played with him at one point in his career, and he thought, well, I think he said he saw Andre a couple of years ago. So, and then finally getting that guy to respond and get to me, and then finally getting the Golden Goose the number for Andre, and then, you know, calling him up, you know, leaving messages for about, I'd say I spent about a year leaving messages, no response. Then I call back again, and finally he responds. We chat, had a nice chat for about a half an hour. And he's like, yeah, well, I'll look for the tapes. We'll meet up. And then another year goes by and nothing. And then I, you know, finally he got back to respond, and we met up at just like a pizza joint by Berklee College of Music. And we just chatted about music for a long time, and, you know, just spending a lot of time for him to get to know me and trust me, because a lot of these guys, you know, they didn't really get a fair shake. And I'm always honest with them and telling them, you know, I'm not Sony Music. I'm not going to be able to have a marketing budget of, you know, $100,000 or something for this, but I do love the music, and I do want to do my best to get it out to the public and in a nice package way that I think will kind of sell itself. And yeah, after that, we finally signed the deal and got everything done and started work on the music.
Now, I would imagine, just because of the kind of detective work that's involved in this, that there also have to be some near misses or you know, things that you want to put out but you haven't been able to track down people. Has that been the case as well?
Yeah, no, that happens a lot. You know, I think all the labels who do this have their, like, you know, top 10 wish lists of stuff. You know, there's a lot of Caribbean stuff that everybody is trying to get, jump in on. And there's some stuff that I'm really itching that will hopefully work together. So
You kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier in one of the things that you were saying, but I've always wondered, with reissue labels like this, is there a feeling that in part some of what you're doing is kind of righting a wrong, almost kind of like multiple wrongs, you know, because a lot of these musicians, they really didn't get a fair shake, as you were saying, from the industry. A lot of the contracts they signed were just horrible contracts. And now there's kind of a chance for people to discover their music again. And it also, you know, that kind of issue too, that here, in addition to, you know, maybe getting a little something back, finally, they also are able to find new audiences, because there's really an audience for a lot of these sounds that wasn't there when they were recording them in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, a lot of these guys, the ones I like dealing with the most, they're really not as concerned about the money. I mean, they're not loaded by any means, and some of them are still very poor, but they're more concerned with just, they had this dream to get this thing out and to get people. And, you know, that's really my goal, to get it out anyway, whether it's on the physical product, on the vinyl, or whether I can get it in a film or on a TV show, just to really get it out. And, you know, I do the best I can to really give them a fair shake and, you know, give them a really solid licensing fee for it. You know, a lot of these things were just regional records that, you know, some of, you know, might have had made a slight dent in their town or city at the time, but it just never took off. And yeah, some of them didn't get a fair shake because of contracts they signed, or possibly they kind of just missed that train. There's one artist that I have, Emmanuel Taylor, and he's got a song called "You Really Got a Hold on Me," different than the Motown one. But when you play, and it was recorded in 1978, but when you play it, it sounds like Stevie Wonder. You know, it sounds exactly like it. I'm wondering, how could this not, at that time, become big on radio? And it kind of just, because it's kind of got the 60s sound to it, and you're late 70s, you know, the industry kind of just shifted, and this guy kind of got screwed out of it, because it really should have been a big hit. It's well-produced and everything. So, you know, I'm hoping they can get out there again in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's the more that you learn both about the music industry that period of time, but also especially radio. I mean, radio in the 1960s and even into the 1970s and 1980s is so different than it's been over the last 20, 25 years. And, you know, one of the things that's happened here in the 21st century, we've had more of an explosion of, thanks to the internet, you know, a lot of different podcasts, blogs. There's like so many different arenas to get music out that just didn't exist then. And it really seems like there's more of a demand for a lot of these artists than there would have been back then.
Yeah, definitely. I think the internet is a great thing, and in that way,
mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that in itself kind of created more interest. You know, more people kind of not having to travel all over the country trying to find these records. They could find some, learn about it on the internet, and you know, learn the story behind it. Sometimes just too much stuff comes out, and as a label, I feel like it's kind of my duty to weed through the stuff that, and this is just my opinion, that mm-hmm. I think is better than others, and try to focus people to get there to that and take a listen to, you know, this is important to listen to. Not to feel, you know, be self-righteous or self-important or anything, but, you know, that's my job. If I'm not doing a good job, then you're not going to buy my records.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I also was, you know, this kind of reissue label thing connected to rare records, especially rare soul, rare funk, highly collectible records, records that sell $500, $1,000, $2,000, like major money for these records. I always wondered how other collectors feel about the work that you do and whether or not, you know, you come out with a reissue of this that now is, you know, moderately priced and something that anybody can afford, whether that then affects the value of the records. And it seems like it could go either way, that it could, you know, drop the price down, or now that more people actually know what it sounds like, it's, you know, makes it even more kind of desired.
Yeah, I would say they hate me pretty much. Mostly the Northern Soul guys in the UK, probably.
Yeah.
But it's kind of strange. Certain thing, it's really a lottery whether it's going to go up or down. It's really kind of like stock market, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It depends, because if something is kind of already been out in the collector market already, and then you put it out, and then, you know, and then someone turns up other copies, then the value does go down. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if it's something that was kind of off the radar and people didn't really pick it up or notice it, you know, then, and now the reissue kind of markets it in a way, it actually helps the collectors. You know, and I say to kind of these guys in the UK that collect the records, they get mad when I reissue it, I say, you know, screw you, because you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot here, because yeah. All these Northern Soul guys are in their 60s and 70s, and unfortunately they don't, you know, they're not as young going out to clubs as much, and by not letting younger kids that are picking up a record of something saying, hey, this is kind of cool, I want to check this out, and kind of passing that down to them, giving it an opportunity to have a copy and play out their like local club, they're kind of killing that, and then no one's going to take the mantle over this great music. And
yeah.
You know, that's kind of what I want for the label, to be able to hand it down for generations to check out and everything.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of kind of the dynamics between musicians who are sampled and hip hop producers and DJs, and that same kind of tension that was between them, that, you know, in a lot of cases it was music that people had just forgotten, and then because they'd sampled it, you know, people were aware and actually sought it out. And it's the same kind of thing. It's like when you hear these sounds and hear them in this somewhat new context, in a different context, songs that you just never would have heard before, it really makes you appreciate just the incredible artistry that's behind a lot of them.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It just seems like from the, you know, early, late 60s, 70s, you know, that era, there was just something about the production that was so classic. I don't know what it was, but it seemed to just, it can't be made up today at all. I mean,
yeah.
There's no way guys could go in the studio, you know, they have all this technology, samplers, you know, keyboards that sample sounds and everything, and they can't get the same out of it that they could back then, which is sad too.
But at the same time, you know, thankful for all the music that and that's the thing that, you know, when I was younger, like in my 20s, and really started getting deeper into digging, you know, I really thought that I knew something, and I'd like, at some point, I was like, well, you know, at some point, I'm just gonna run out of records. Like, everybody's gonna know the records, there's not going to be any more records to discover. And now, you know, like almost 20 years later, it's like I still come up with stuff. It's like I've never heard that. I've never heard that. It's just, it's amazing, like, how much music really is still out there to be discovered.
Yeah, it's amazing. And again, a lot of the stuff was all, you know, regionally done, these small towns where there was, you know, it was kind of a boom town for America. You know, the economy in the 60s was doing pretty well. And, you know, studios would pop up and you go pay that, you know, just get 300 copies pressed, pay them, you know, $300, and people could afford that. And they did one and it was their chance to make it. And, you know, fortunately, a lot of times didn't make it at all. And, you know, but there's just so many records in this country, even though a lot of guys from the UK and Japan bought all of them, but there's still the warehouse somewhere, and, you know, stuff that guys who like Northern Soul said, you know, who really dug deep, were like, I don't like modern soul. I don't, you know, I don't like deep funk. That sounds, you know, I don't like that. So there is still stuff being discovered all the time, which makes it exciting for us collectors and record label people to try to put that out. So.
Yeah, and I would think that in particular, one of the things that collectors aren't generally privy to, but people who actually do this kind of work, do the work that you do, a lot of times these musicians have either, you know, like they have masters, they have unreleased things that they recorded, but they just never got released. And I would imagine that's got to be thrilling when you know about something, but then there's kind of extra music that you didn't know about.
Yeah, there is always. Sometimes it doesn't turn out like it was that great. You know, and sometimes it does. Like this project we're putting out. We put out the first Stanton Davis record, Brighter Days, and we're doing an album of unreleased stuff that's been kind of just sitting around in his house, an album called Isis Voyage that has some cuts that were just never played out or, you know, hadn't been released at all, and were kind of just sitting there. So it was pretty exciting to hear. And there's some interesting sounds, keyboard sounds and things you can hear on it. So,
in addition to the Stanton Davis, what else is coming down the pipe from Cultures of Soul?
We got a few things in the pipeline. We're also working. There's a DJ in the UK called Andy Smith. He does sort of Northern Soul and Rockabilly, and he did this series called Jam Up Twist, and he has a DJ night there that's pretty big. So him and I partnered, and we're putting out another volume of that. It's got a cool package that's going to come with it. It's got your traditional CD, but then we've also got a 7-inch box set.
Oh, nice.
Has 7 45s in it. Stuff that he plays, the Rockabilly, but also a lot of Northern Soul and R&B stuff that's pretty exclusive. So
cool.
Pretty interesting.
Cool. We'll be looking for that. Now, we have you here, and you bought a gang of records, so we're going to have you get set up, and at the top of the hour, we got a guest DJ set from Dino Sounds, but you were mentioning this earlier, and I think you wanted to actually leave us with a little taste of that Stanton Davis, no?
Yes, I do. This is a track. Actually, the original album was recorded in 1977, a Brighter Days album. He kind of chopped down songs. I mean, Stanton Davis and the Ghetto Mysticism Band was a pretty well-known jazz outfit playing in, you know, in Somerville and in Boston and just these dark rooms and everything. And they would just jam out these songs that were 10, 18 minutes long. And then when he went to go put the record together, you know, he really tried to make it accessible. He kind of chopped the songs down to 4 or 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And this one you're going to hear is actually the beginning part of Brighter Days. It's a track called Delta 6, and it's really, really got an interesting sound, and you'll see it melds into the Brighter Days track where it was originally faded in.
Okay, and this is, at the moment, unreleased. You guys are, when are you guys putting this out?
The intro part is all unreleased, and the whole package is coming out January 21st of next year. So
we love exclusives here. All right, so this is music that was previously unreleased from Stanton Davis. It'll be released by Cultures of Soul at the beginning of the new year. Thank you so much again for coming in. And I'm really, I know you guys out there, you're also looking forward to this guest DJ set. Dino Sounds getting ready to set up and play you a whole gang of music. But right now, once again, this is music from Stanton Davis, and you're hearing it on KPFK and Melting Pot.
Thank you.